On the latest Into Music, Frankie Sunswept talks library cards, open mics, and the power of being a student.
I've learned more being a music teacher than anything at this point.
That's Into Music, a new podcast from KMUW. You can find it at KMUW.org, on your KMUW app, and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Scott Guild, and my book is titled Plastic.
Scott Guild's debut novel, Plastic, is set in an alternate world about 50 years in the future. But with climate change, gun violence, and nuclear fallout, this dystopian comedy looks eerily similar to our world. The only difference? The characters in Plastic are, well, plastic. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Scott Guild. So I'd like to start by having you give our listeners a description of the book, because I'm not exactly sure where to jump in on this one, and I bet you have I bet you have a pretty good elevator pitch.
That's so funny, because at my event last night in Texas with Elizabeth McCracken, she said one of the things she liked about the book was that it resisted an easy elevator pitch, and she wanted me to give an elevator pitch. So, and I sat there stupefied for a moment, so I'm very excited that I practiced for the question. And you would agree that you feel like this book resists an easy elevator pitch as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, do you want me to try it? No, I'm not going to.
you don't have to. I just find it, because for me, you know, when you're with something so long, it doesn't feel nearly as complicated sometimes as, you know, you invite people into your world of plastic figurines with eco-terrorist explosions going off and the hinges and the hollow bodies, and then it's a musical as well. And to me, it all just seems like, well, of course, naturally, this would be the book, because I've been with it for 10 years, you know. But for the outside reader, there's perhaps a lot to take in all at once. So when I describe the book, I usually start with the fact that it's set in a world of plastic figurines, thus the title Plastic, and that you're going into this alternate space that in some ways resembles our own, but in other ways is quite different, and is set in about, you know, 2070, 2080, a little further along in the 21st century, but of course a plastic version of that that is alternate from our own in some ways. And then, you know, I say it's the story of a person really looking for love and connection in a world that's very chaotic and filled with a lot of despair and problems with the climate crisis advanced. And underneath all that, I think even with everything going on in the book, it's primarily a love story and about someone attempting to find love, even in the midst of a world that is plastic and is in a state of chaos. So not that different from our own situation in some ways.
So even though it is set in an alternate world, it resembles our world, even the issues that we're, you know, seeing today, the news cycle and our daily lives, you know, these issues dominate those two things, gun violence, environmental destruction, virtual reality. And, you know, we were supposed to have this conversation 2 weeks ago until I had an emergency website crisis and we had to postpone. But then 2 weeks ago, I wouldn't have known about the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which bans all orbital nuclear weapons, or that there are questions about whether Russia is even planning to abandon that treaty. So how much did you know about all of these things that we're facing and that your characters are facing? I mean, I know it's futuristic and otherworldly, and the bombs and the wars are set in the future. But did you have to do research into, like, war or eco-terrorism or climate change, like all of the things that your characters had to deal with?
I mean, I'd love to say that I made myself an expert on these things, and that I wasn't just trying to be, you know, the good concerned progressive, you know, reading the New York Times and the Atlantic and things like that. But I do think that the space that my main character Aaron is at, and sort of the space that I was at while I was writing the book, was just one of feeling that as a species, we really have the capacity to destroy ourselves, and we're not really taking intelligent steps to prevent our own destruction. In terms of the climate crisis, in terms of the weaponry we have, and in terms of how we relate to each other as nations with this powerful technology to harm one another, as we're seeing so often, you know, nowadays, even ramping up more and more even this year in a lot of terrifying ways. So I don't think I made myself an expert on these issues beyond the normal run of just, you know, being a citizen concerned about these things. But there was a question in the course of writing the book of how to make these stakes really intimate and personal for my main character. And in the early stages of writing the book, those elements were more kind of exterior and just something that was unsettling my main character. And part of the journey of writing the book was finding ways to make the climate crisis something that was intimately a part of Erin's life and the life of her family, and making nuclear weaponry and the disastrous possibilities of war also really intimate to the life of those characters. So I hope that answered your question, or if maybe I just went on rambling about my characters. But.
Well, I want to talk about one of your characters, because you mentioned Erin. Yes. You know, yes. So much of Erin's present experience comes from her relationship with her sister, Fiona. And I want to avoid spoilers, but can you talk a little bit about their relationship, the relationship between Erin and Fiona?
Yes. So what ultimately developed in the writing of the book is that Erin has a sibling, Fiona, who is very political and very concerned ethically and otherwise about the future of the planet. And again, this is taking place in the 2070s and the 2080s, where the climate crisis has advanced in some ways. And because there hasn't been that much meaningful political action, in fact, kind of going in the opposite direction, people are feeling much more angry and much more intense about it and taking much more extreme action as a result, because they feel that political violence is the only solution, right? So Fiona is looped into that world and feels very strongly about it, whereas Erin is dealing with her own grief and trauma and just isn't the same type of person who's thinking in those global terms. She has much more of an intimate sense of her family relationships and trying to find love, and isn't contemplating global issues the way her sister is. So they end up having, without giving any spoilers, they end up having a very complicated relationship. And it is something ultimately that Erin is forced to confront and forced to think about, even if there are no simple answers for her.
I want to talk about the dialogue and speech these plastic characters use. It's shortened. I mean, pronouns are often removed and words are shortened to communicate faster. It's like contractions have been eliminated in an effort to make the words even shorter. But Erin's thought monologues are complete sentences, and she explains, I'd catch myself thinking in longer sentences, narrating my life to myself in that old-fashioned dialect. Can you talk to me about the idea behind this shortened, futuristic way of speaking?
Yeah, that was amazing. You even had the line ready to discuss it. I was very impressed by that. That was awesome. Yes, I think part of going into this future was thinking about how language changes, because language is always shifting and changing around us, and language is matching the conditions of our world, right? So in the future where Erin lives, people talk in a way that's very boiled down, and they speak as if they're texting to each other, and maybe even in more of a clipped form than we currently text to each other. The way people speak to each other almost resembles very hurried Instagram comments or something like that, you know, where it's like, this chicken, wow, wow, I do good today, like, where you go now, you know, and, the challenge of writing that kind of dialogue is keeping it human and full and making sure real emotion and personality is being conveyed. Because when you first encounter it, when you're first reading that sort of dialogue in the book, it is comedy, or it's striving at comedy, and is probably, you know, the reader is probably thinking, well, this is funny, but am I going to read a full book of this? Like, you know, and actually at the event with Elizabeth McCracken last night, she was saying, when she first encountered that, she didn't like it, and she thought, oh no, here comes a whole book. But then she acclimated to it very quickly and found that it wasn't undermining the depth of the characters. And I let out a huge sigh of relief that I think maybe unsettled the audience a little bit, just because I admire her so much. And I was like, oh no, you know, so I was like, thank goodness. She began the sentence about that without indicating how it was going to resolve in a positive way. So that was nice. At the same time, Erin loves this TV show called Nuclear Family. That's from an earlier, it's like historical fiction, essentially. It's a TV show set in an earlier time that uses a fuller language. And she's so immersed in her fandom of that TV show that she actually starts thinking in fuller sentences and has a relationship with the older language that kind of mingles with and matches her relationship to her father. And her relationship with her father is one of the main emotional relationships for her in the book. So she does have, when she goes into the past and thinks about her father, she does have this almost fuller internal world that is narrated by her to the, I mean, this is also another part of the book, the disembodied camera that follows her around, right? You see, I promise to readers it all makes sense if you dive in and give it a moment. But when she narrates to the camera, she's narrating in this fuller language that actually, I mean, I was hoping it felt like coming from the clipped language, they're speaking to each other, that when we go inside Aaron's mind and emotions, that opening of the fuller language matches what an internal life is like versus how we sometimes have to relate to each other in more clipped ways.
So did you have to create your own dictionary of future speak?
I did, yes. And there was a moment, I'm a recovering future speak addict, you know, but there was a moment where, you know, I'd walk out of the office and my wife would be like, well, you know, what would you like for dinner? And I'd go, dinner, good question, you know, and I would have to, you know.
Probably not chicken, right?
Probably not. No, no chicken. I'm a vegan, you know, which probably underlies some of the chicken rendering in the book too.
So talk to me about the idea of plastic. I read a recent piece in the LA Times, and I understand that you were inspired in some part by Barbie. Talk to me about that.
Not the Greta. I mean, I love the Greta Gerwig Barbie, right. But this was a moment in 2013 that article was talking about, where I was watching this kind of dark horror movie with my stepbrother and some friends at his house. And all of a sudden somebody came over with their children and they were right at the door, and there was like a mad scramble at the remote to put on something child appropriate. And this animated Barbie show replaced the images on the screen, and it was the stiff figurines walking around and, you know, creaking and and this kind of Barbie world that was jagged and strange and surreal in many of the ways that the horror movie had been. And it created this imaginative moment for me where I realized, like, oh, wait a second, if you put like real characters and real drama into a Barbie world with these bodies, that might be interesting and that might be something. So yeah, there was kind of an imaginative overlay there. Of course, then it took me 5 years to do anything with it. I think that's how it often happens.
So I want to talk about the music in this book. You were the songwriter and lead guitarist for the new wave band New Collisions, but you left the band behind to write literature. And I read that somewhere along the way in the writing of this book, you began to think of it as a musical. And you have simultaneously released a soundtrack. Talk to me about this. Mm-hmm.
In the novel, there is this character named Morris, who is, the best way to describe him would be a singing, dancing crucifix. He's about a foot tall, and he comes down off the cross and performs songs and, you know, changes from the loincloth into a seersucker suit and a top hat and performs things like that. But he wasn't always that. There was one day I was working on the book, and I started thinking, what if this odd talking crucifix in my book suddenly burst into song and there was a musical number surrounding this character? The book had already sold to my publisher at that point. I mean, this was a late stage of the edits, and I went to my editor and said, hey, can I have musical numbers in my book? Could I make this a musical? And Anna Kaufman, my wonderful editor, was very game for it. So then I was able to go back through the whole book and find moments where it could be zany and fun, like with Morris, but also where it could be more like a soliloquy or a monologue of Aaron kind of breaking the fourth wall and speaking her emotions directly in song. So that was the first step, was turning the book into a musical of sorts. And then once I had that, I realized, oh, wait a second, I've created a full album inside of my book, almost without realizing I was doing it. And then the musician part of me got involved and thought, oh, what if there was actually an album connected to this? And Pantheon, my publisher, was very up for that as well. And I had the great opportunity to work with one of my favorite musicians in the world. His name is Johnny Rogers, and he performs as Cinder Talk. And he's been doing albums I've loved for years. So I had the chance to connect with him. And then he connected us with the singer Stranger Cat, or Cat Martino, who really took on Aaron as a character and learned all about Aaron and plays her on the album. So the album isn't just songs randomly taken from the book, but it's almost a retelling of the story with Stranger Cat performing as Aaron. Now the two things are coming out simultaneously, and it's exciting.
You know, you mentioned the editing process, and I have a question about that in a moment, but I want to talk about the audiobook for a minute, because it wasn't just a straight reading of the book. Talk to me about the extras that readers / you know, listeners can find in the audiobook.
It was a wonderful opportunity that Penguin Random House gave me to be involved in the audiobook, in the creation of the audiobook, which is not always the case for authors. But in this case, because I had the soundtrack and the music, And because by sheer chance, the director of the audiobook is my second cousin, Lisa Watstein. This just sort of, so shout out to Lisa, who's coming to the event in LA tonight. Like, yay, Lisa. Lisa came on board and was like, Scotty, you know, she's known me since I was like four or something. And that was almost like a coincidence that that happened. So she read my book and I had songs that could work as chapter transitions. So we took parts of the songs and used them as transitions between chapters. We open and close the audiobook with music from the album. So that music I created actually then becomes a part of the audiobook experience in a way that's so fun and I'm so grateful for. And in some of the Nuclear Family episodes, there's a laugh track, and they even went along with my suggestion to take out the lines about the laugh track and just put in laughter that matches the description. So, I mean, what an opportunity. And they brought in a second reader for the episodes too. So the producer on that was an incredible Grammy-winning producer named Dan Zitt. And he was willing to go along with all this and to just get super creative. And yeah, the editor, Chris Howerton, it was a wonderful team that came together around creating the book, the audiobook.
Earlier, you mentioned that you had come up with an idea and you would have to go back and edit after you had worked on the book for 5 years and you would have to go back and edit. And so I think this is a question about editing, like the editing process of the physical book, because in terms of timeline, how long before it goes to print can you make the final edit? And here's the reason I'm asking.
It depends how how much you want to push things, you know?
Well, I'm asking because I read the print.
Yeah, everyone was very nice to me. Very nice to me.
Yeah. I read the printed advanced reader copy of Plastic, but then I listened to a preview audio as I read. And I do this a lot. And usually, you know, there's usually not that much of a difference between the audio and the text. But I have learned, you know, years ago I was talking to Ethan Kanan at a party and I was talking to him about America, America. And when I told him I read the preview copy, he's like, well, I added a complete chapter after the galley. So you haven't read the book.
Wow. And a complete chapter. It's good. No one told me that was an option. It's really good. I didn't know.
Well, this this felt like, you know, there were a lot of times when the audio did not match what was in the book. And I was just wondering how much did you push that deadline right before it went to press? Were you still making edits?
I'll answer your question this way. It would not match it about 1,436 times because that's how many edits I made to there's a PDF you're given. It's not like you're editing a Word doc at that point. You're given a PDF that shows you what the book is going to look like. And then on Adobe, you can go in and make those types of changes. And at the end, there was 1,400 of those. And I was very apologetic. That was a very apologetic email I sent. That was because I had so many sentences. I wanted to give one final polish. The book had been in my life for 10 years. So yeah, June to July 2023 was a moment of a lot of Adobe PDF editing, more than I ever thought I would ever have, you know. But they were everyone was very generous to me. The copy editor, Kayla Overby, is a hero. And Kayla, if you're listening, thank you from the bottom of my heart for July of 2023.
Booksellers and book reviewers, you know that line that says this uncorrected proof should not be quoted without comparison to the actual book? You know, that's true.
More true in some cases than others. But no one said I could add a chapter. Now that I know that, that's dangerous. I wish I hadn't heard.
Okay, so tell me, what is Brad Pitt disease and why Brad Pitt?
That's interesting. So I had Brad Pitt disease since very early in the book. Like when I came in to my first graduate MFA workshop in 2013, I had Brad Pitt disease in the book. And that was actually so much of what you're mentioning in a fun way was part of my my event last night. Elizabeth McCracken was saying, like, I'm so glad Brad Pitt disease made it through 10 years because so much didn't, so much changed. But Brad Pitt disease was always a favorite for some reason. I don't know if people want something bad to happen to Brad Pitt. I don't know. But of course, it's a plastic version of what happens to Brad Pitt, you know, so it's never narrativized in the book, like what happened in Brad Pitt's life. But it's kind of like Lou Gehrig disease. Like, you know, it wasn't good. You know, you know, I don't know if it's too soon with Lou Gehrig to make a joke there. Maybe it's It's been a while. Poor Lou Gehrig. Anyway, so yeah, so Brad Pitt disease turns plastic figurines to ash. Their plastic skin slowly morphs into ash. And it's introduced comic, but then when you go into the past where Aaron's father is dying of this slow-moving disease and it's rendered in kind of literary fiction terms in a way, it probably becomes less funny. I know, Beth, what was your experience of that? Did you find Brad Pitt disease funny in the end? Were you chuckling to the
in the end? No.
Yeah.
No, I mean that was my experience with this entire book. I mean, what starts out as okay, trying to get my bearings.
Right.
And you know, it's a completely different book when you finish it than when you began. Mm. Well, I guess all books are, but
but some books more than others, right? Just like my copy editing journey. Yeah.
Well, we have talked about a lot without spoiling, I don't think, except maybe Brad Pitt. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked?
Oh, gosh, that's a really good question. You know, one thing that's been really exciting is with everything that's gone into the project and all the collaborators I've had, the actual book reading side of it, the live show part of it has been a really fun thing where I've been able to bring in live music and bring in different collaborators. So at the New York City debut of the book or the book launch event, Stranger Cat came up from Miami and performed the songs. And I was able to read the book up until the moment when the songs come in. So Aaron would be introduced to singing a song and then the music would click on and Stranger Cat would actually sing it. And that's something I've only been able to experience in the last week or so because, you know, I had to wait for the book to come out to have these events and so forth. So that's been really exciting. And that's been going on now. There's a music event tonight because I'm on the West Coast and Cinder Talk, Johnny Rogers is coming to the event to perform. So it's been really cool to see that there's this whole other kind of quasi stage life now happening in bookstores, and booksellers have been really fun and excited about it too, that there's these, you know, musical things happening in their bookstores as part of the reading. So I've just been having a blast with that part as well.
Well, the book is Plastic. Scott Guild, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This was a delight.
That was Scott Guild, author of the book Plastic, which was published by Pantheon. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.